living hell.
This is what real hope looks like. This is the word that those hopeless people need to hear. This is the word that 3,000 people that try to commit suicide today, the 3,000 that will try to commit tomorrow, 3,000 that will try to commit on Monday, this is the word that they need to hear, is that there is hope.
It's real superpower. It's hope. There's hope. It means hope.
Welcome to Victims and Villains. This is the show where we talk nerd, we talk hope, and we speak nothing else. And I'm your host, Captain Nostalgia, and I am extremely excited to introduce our guest for this episode. Please help me in welcoming one of the creators behind series like The Boys, Happy, and more, Mr. Derek Robertson. So tell us a little bit about yourself, man, and how you kind of got started doing art.
I've drawn my whole life. Ever since I can remember, I could hold a pen. I would draw just to occupy myself, and I found it fascinating. I love the act of being alone in my own thoughts and creating pictures.
So you kind of talk about the act of being alone with your thoughts. What does that kind of look like, I guess, when it's not like the comic medium?
Oh, that would be a hard thing to separate from me, because I don't mentally separate comics from anything else I draw. To me, it's all art. You know, it's just what I love about comics is that it's a visual storytelling medium. And that's kind of what drew me to it at a very young age, is I love the storytelling element of it more than the actual drawing. I like the unfolding of the story. Same thing that I love about animation. I love how you can take 200 drawings and make it a motion, you know. So in comic books, you can take these panels upon panels and turn them into a story. It's not the act of the drawing; it's the sequential art.
So, what were some of the first series that kind of got you interested in comic books and kind of made a point where you're like, I want to do this the rest of my life?
Yeah, I was really young when that hit me. I think it was 1979, and I'd read comics and seen comics, but I'd never really connected with them. I was more into the Peanuts and Disney from a young age, and Looney Tunes, stuff like that, that you'd see on television. And that was then, I think, the only real connection to comics I had was the Batman TV show, the Batman 66. But I used to go to a pharmacy, this back when they sold comics on the newsstand, and it was a copy of Flash 272, and had this incredible Jose Garcia Lopez cover. And it just, something about it grabbed my eye, because it was such a dynamic layout, and something about it just made me want to look at that comic. And when I opened it up, there was all these, the splash page had images of the Flash running in sequence, and I could follow it with my eye, and that just blew my mind. Like, it looked like he was running if I just followed it with my eye. I thought that was the coolest thing I ever saw. I'm 9 years old. And, but I realized that I could, you know, somebody did that. And it started to put together that I saw that all the comic books I had this credits in it. And I'm like, wait, this is somebody's job. And I thought, that could be my job. And so I made up my mind, probably a couple of years later, after I started drawing superhero stuff and trying to do comics, I made my own comic book by stapling, you know, paper together and then filling it in. And that was, I don't know, I kind of got the bug that young. And I made up my mind at a young age, like, this is what I want to do. And I'm the creepy kid that did it. I'm doing it, you know, 40 years later.
And the art has just really grown, you know.
Yeah, hope. If I was still drawing like I did when I was 9, I don't think I'd be doing this professionally. But I might have a show on Cartoon Network, but I wouldn't be doing work.
So I want to kind of jump in and you know, talk about The Boys and Happy here in just a few minutes. But you have also actually gotten to work on iconic characters like Wolverine and Conan. So what's it like to work on properties that are so iconic and just have such a high status to a lot of fandoms?
It's interesting. My love for Wolverine goes back to around the same time I was just getting into comics. It was like 4 years later, I kind of pivoted from DC to Marvel for a while and discovered the X-Men. And so all my early sketchbooks from the early 80s are full of drawings of Wolverine and Nightcrawler and Rogue. And I love those characters like they were friends of mine. And so as I moved up in my career, and finally got a chance to work for Broken to Mainstream, my first assignment ever at Marvel was fill an issue of Wolverine 54, I think it was. And that was a big deal for me because it was like something I had always dreamed of doing. So it felt more like I had achieved a dream, and I didn't really wrap my head around. He wasn't as iconic in 1992 as he is even now. Like, he was like, nobody really knew who Wolverine was. I was like all crazy and happy running around telling people, like, I'm working on Wolverine. They'd go, who's that? You know, if I told them Spider-Man or Superman, they knew that then. But in that, you know, it wasn't until the movies hit that he really got on people's radar. I guess actually that's not fair. That Marvel cartoon in the 90s was very popular of the X-Men. And so that's kind of like people's earliest memories of Wolverine that I run into. But he didn't really even get mainstream until till around 2003 when the X-Men movies started coming out. So it was weird. It was like seeing, in a weird way, it was like somebody, it was like seeing my friend go off to college, you know, like the guy that I used to go and throw rocks in the river with is now like a big star somewhere else and I don't get to talk to him anymore. So that's what Wolverine's like. He's not mine anymore. He used to be my personal thing, and then it became the world's thing, and then I got to work on him, and then I didn't. So Conan was a little different. I grew up with Conan. I had a Conan action figure from the Mego collection when I was a little boy. It was my main memory of Conan was that stupid action figure. Had a wig, you know, but he was fun. But I love the drawing that John Buscema had done that was on the package. And I used to try to draw that, and I got to write and draw Conan the little bit that I worked on him. So writing, and I'm not known for my writing, but it was one of the few times I got to work with a major character and get a pretty big audience for writing and drawing. And Conan's really fun to write because it's kind of like climbing into a tank. You know, you can like make him go anywhere. You know, you can like Conan will think things through, and Conan can handle almost anything. So, you know, it's just sheer strength and will. So but it's interesting because with both properties, people bring their own opinions. And no matter what you do, no matter how well you draw it or how well you write it, somebody else is going to say that's not how it's done. So with Wolverine, you know, even though I was a lifelong fan, I could at the time told you his history and what his Marvel, you know, handbook stats were. I had other people saying he's not that short. I'm like, he's 5'3". And that was a problem because I like to draw him as 5'3". I thought that was really cool that out of all these superheroes, you had this one little guy who's kind of aged and angry and smokes cigars and drinks in bars and, you know, could go toe-to-toe with the Hulk, but he's, you know, more than a foot shorter than, about a foot shorter than Scott Summers. But then you see him, you know, some artists would handle him in the comics where he'd be eye-to-eye with Scott Summers, and they'd be arguing. But that doesn't make sense because that's the foot difference, right. You know. I'm not a tall man. I'm an average height man, and I'm 5'8". So that means he's, you know, 5 inches shorter than I am, which means he would come up to my shoulder. And most of my friends, I don't know why, but I have all of my closest friends are tall. And so I'm around tall guys all the time, and I'm really aware of what people that are over 6 foot look like. And I know where I come up to them. So Wolverine would come up to there on me. You know, so visually it just made sense to me. It's still in the Marvel handbook that he's 5'3" right. tall. You know, but there would be argument about that. Like I had trouble from editorial, and I had trouble from, you know, fans that would be like, no, you're drawing him wrong. I'm like, and I remember the funniest argument I got into about it was saying, look, I get it. You're a Wolverine fan, but so am I. I liked Wolverine so much that I'm a self-taught artist that went from loving him as a teenager to working as hard as I could and I'm the guy on the book now. I win. I'm the bigger fan. I'm sorry. I dedicated my life to this. But, you know, they don't like, people don't like hearing that. But I'm a big nerd, obviously, yeah. You know. Looking in, you know, my studio is surrounded, I'm surrounded with action figures to this day. I love this stuff. It's in my blood.
It's a gorgeous setup. It's every, like, you guys listening to this right now, you can't see it. Take out everything, literally from Daredevil, Darth Vader, Batman.
that's my quick reference shelf. I had an earthquake in here about 2 years ago, and so everything ended up on the floor and broke. A lot of it broke, but then so it never got quite back to the organization it was. That used to, you guys can't see this, but that used to have shelving on it that came down off the wall, and I had to just put stuff back up in its place. But anyway, but big nerd.
So you'd mentioned writing for Conan. What was it like from switching from being an artist on a book to, you know, calling the shots both as writer and artist?
Well, I started in comics writing and drawing my own stuff. So it's not weird for me. I am fortunate enough that I've been able to work with some of the best writers in the business. And so in a lot of ways, I've always put my own stuff aside because, you know, when I can work with the likes of Warren Ellis, I'm not going to write my own stories. I'm going to collaborate with somebody who's a better writer than I am, because, you know, he can't draw and I can't write as well as he does. So that's strength to strength. But as far as doing my own stuff, I really enjoy it. I'm currently writing and drawing a book. So it's fun for me. I like to write, and I'm going to be doing more of that in my future, but I'm just not known for it. I did get published a few times over before I wrote Conan. The difference is that I'll actually sit and write a script for myself, even though I'm drawing it. And then when it comes time to draw it, I really don't like myself as a writer, as the artist in me and the writer in me don't like each other. Because I can imagine stuff that I love on paper, and then when I go to draw it, I'll be like, what the hell was I thinking? You know, this doesn't work. I hate me. So the grousing that I would normally save for a writer I'm working with falls on my own shoulders.
So with writing, you know, if you were just to take as, you know, push a book out just solely writing, who would you want as, like, you know, do you ever have an artist you'd ever like to work with, like kind of like the way that you guys?
Oh God, yeah. I can, if I wrote a story and I could pick my own artist. Oh my God, I have a long list. Yes, absolutely. Short off the top of my head, I'd love to write a story for Adam Hughes. I'd love to write a story for Kevin Maguire. I'd love to write a story for Dave Gibbons. I'd love to write a story for Kevin Nolan, John Cassaday, Cully Hamner. Yeah, that list goes on and on. Almost everybody I respect and love their work, I would be thrilled if I could write a story for those guys.
I'd be interested in seeing you and Dave Gibbons team up. I think you guys would have an interesting project.
Yeah, I get along with Dave. Dave and I get along. He's a good person.
So we're talking about creator owned properties here, and you are probably most famous for The Boys, Happy, and
Transmetropolitan.
Yes, that was the last one. I just didn't want to butcher that, so I'm so glad you said it.
That's funny, because that's usually the first one people mention. So I was...
The Boys is actually the one that got me into your work. But what's the difference in the creative atmosphere working on books like these compared to books for, like, you know, Marvel or Dark Horse on, like, more famous properties?
Well, you know, it's when it's creator owned and you're doing something from scratch, it's freeing, because nobody can tell me that I'm drawing my own characters wrong. You know, like I wouldn't run into the same conflicts that I ran into with Wolverine, and Conan was very well received, so I didn't have a whole lot of conflict there. But with Wolverine, a lot of different people brought their ideas of what Wolverine should look like, and then you had a lot of cooks in the kitchen, and that's not fun. I don't like that. Because there are people, you know, with Wolverine for specifically, you know, I think about when I came onto the book, I thought, you know, you look at Barry Windsor Smith's Wolverine, you look at Frank Miller's Wolverine, you look at Sam Keith's Wolverine, you look at John J. Muth's Wolverine, and they all had a very distinct look. You look at Jim Lee's Wolverine, you look at John Byrne's Wolverine. They all are different from one another. Everybody was able to bring their own style to that character, and it felt like when I got my turn, then everybody else wanted to tell me how he was supposed to be drawn. And that didn't seem right to me. That didn't seem like I got my fair shot, I didn't like having that many cooks in my kitchen because I had a clear vision of what I wanted to do. And it was very successful, and then all of a sudden there were cooks in the kitchen. And that's usually that's the old adage that success has 1,000 fathers and failure is an orphan. So I had that experience where I suddenly everybody, you know, and Wolverine was blowing up as a merchandising thing right at the time I got my shot at him. So, you know, they wouldn't let him smoke anymore. And I'm like, he's got a healing factor. They didn't want to argue about it. You know, people in control, you know, he's a Disney character now, put it that way. He was on his way to becoming a Disney character. You know, but at the time too, they were like, you can't show any blood in the comics, because it was this transition where I had come off of doing Max comics, which, you know, were very well received and sold very well. And then suddenly I'm working on a comic where I'm not allowed, like Wolverine pops his claws, but he can't do anything with them. I had a silhouette of somebody's hand coming off, and they censored that, you know. It's like I wasn't, but then you look at the movie Logan that came out, and it's the Wolverine I was drawing. It's the violence that I was putting into my comic, and they wouldn't let me do that stuff. So when it comes to the boys, all the gloves were off, because that was our universe. Garth and I created this universe that, you know, it could be as dark and nasty as it needed to be. It was part of the story. It was important that it was dark and nasty, because that was the theme, that these people that look so nice on the surface, you know, follow Rome, the Caligula days are happening behind the scenes, you know, but they had the comic books and the action figures and all that, and the movies as PR. It was propaganda. So you would think that, you know, the Homelander was this great, perfect guy who came from another planet or whatever his made-up origin was. But in truth, he was grown in a lab, and he was controlled by the government, and he's a horrible person, you know. But the PR people are out there ahead of him. That's what the cost, you know. And then people said, oh, you can't make fun of Superman like that. I'm like, he's not Superman. He's the Homelander. Their costumes, that's the point. It's like, you don't just put somebody in a Superman costume and he's not Superman, because character matters. You know, Clark Kent is Superman. Clark Kent would never do the things that the Homelander does. And that was the point, you know. But the freedom to explore those themes and the freedom to do the artwork as hard-hitting as I wanted to was very gratifying. So that's the upside.
That's what, you know, we bring on independent creators on the show all the time, whether it's, you know, filmmakers or comic creators, YouTubers, and they also talk about that freedom and just the ability to not be censored, but, you know, truly share a vision that they have. And it sounds like you guys have had great success with publishers like, you know, Dynamite and Image being behind you guys full 100%.
Yeah, it was interesting. You know, we started out at Wildstorm, and it was supposed to be a big book for Wildstorm, where they used to be an Image company, and then DC got them, and it was short-lived, but they were going to try to become kind of a home for creators again like that, and it just didn't work out because there was oversight from the larger umbrella that, up the ladder, and they didn't like what we were doing, so they ended up canceling us, and which was good for us in the end. We went over, but we got offers from every publisher in the industry as soon as that, because it was a great selling book. It was already a hit when they canceled us. So logically, the people at the time didn't like what we were doing, and they were afraid of the content. And then ironically, we went on to being very successful. Dynamite picked us up. We chose Dynamite. And then they picked us up, and we did very well there. And now it's going to be an Amazon TV series. So, you know, we were ahead of the curve on what we were creating. It's just the publishers weren't ready to move forward. I kind of ran into that at Marvel as well. It's like Marvel was doing really fun stuff, and I came in at a time they were feeling very aggressive. And then as the success started to come in from movies and TVs, you could feel the change within what they were comfortable doing in editorial. And I feel like I didn't quite fit that mold anymore. Like, they didn't know what to do with me in that you know, the Max line was going away, and that's sort of where I had come in and hit my groove. And so when I walked away from that, I went with the same writer I was doing a lot of the Max titles with, and we went and did our own thing.
All right, so The Boys is actually getting ready to – its development has started on to becoming, like you were saying earlier, an Amazon Prime series. So I want to start off by saying that it's got to be extremely exciting for you as a creator to have one of these properties that you kind of nurtured from creation to publication to now being a TV show. So how excited are you about the TV show?
I'm very excited because I think TV is a great format. I'm really excited that it's going to a place like Amazon as a streaming series because from our experience with the comics, I have a feeling if they tried to make it work on commercial television, it would have run into the same trouble that the original comic book series did. You know, people not quite ready for a show that has superhero characters acting awful. But I think the timing of it is perfect because everything in the Hollywood is like 15 years behind where comics has been. As far as like Hollywood is just now discovering how cool the Avengers are and how cool X-Men are and how cool Black Panther is, like as if it's a brand new thing. You know, Black Panther has been around since 1974 and Hollywood just found it, you know, or found him. So that property. But I think that so in that regard, I'm really excited. Also, I'm thrilled because the people that are involved with the directing and the producing have reached out to me and I've had a chance to talk to some of them. And Eric Kripke, for example, is a big fan of the comic and he really wanted to be everybody working on this really wants to be working on this. And at least that's what I've experienced and been told. So it's not like people getting an assignment and going, what is this thing I'm working on? It's people that are like, oh, my God, I want to work on that. So, you know, I love what Seth Rogen and Evan Goldberg did with Preacher. So I'm excited to see what they bring to The Boys. Eric Kripke is a big, you know, big fan of the book and has told me so. And he wants to really capture what makes it work. So it's not going to be exactly the comic. I know there are going to be changes because that's just the nature of Hollywood. And, you know, very rarely does anything get adapted perfectly. But at the same time, that doesn't make it a bad thing. For example, I really love Ruth Negga as Tulip on Preacher. And, you know, she works better as that character in my opinion, than if they had cast her to look like she did in the comic. But so if they make these changes for The Boys, I'm okay with that. But just knowing that like Carl Urban is going to be Butcher, he's perfect. He looks great. You know, Karen Fukuhara as female, perfect. And I saw Suicide Squad. I thought she'd be good for the female and she's going to be the female. That's exciting for me. I love that. So, you know, those elements about it are great. I don't think it's going to really feel legit until I see like the cast photo of them all in costume or, you know, the seven. They've cast all of the seven and I've not seen any costuming or anything yet. So I think when that stage comes, I'm going to be really thrilled, you know, because then it's going to feel legit. But and also I've been on this roller coaster for about 10 years now because they first optioned The Boys in 2008 and it was supposed to be a film and then it stopped and then it was over here to be a film and it stopped. Now it's Sony and it was going to go to Cinemax and then it was, you know, so it's like it's moved positions, but it's never been dead as a property. It's just always been, it's about to happen. It isn't happening. It's about to happen. It isn't happening. So I know this is going to happen because they're casting. I mean, it's legit now, but you know, it still is this thing where I'm like almost waiting for it to not happen again because I almost don't want to dare to dream. But, you know, we're getting close, though. So I think it's going to be out next year, and I'm really thrilled to see. And I love that it feels like it's good that it didn't happen when it did because now is the right time for it, and it's in the right place with the right people. So there's a feeling that it's all coming together in the way it will do the best. And I'm excited, too, because a guy like Seth Rogen and Evan Goldberg, like, those are guys that if they're on Amazon.com, like, they're going to do so great. With the gloves off, you know?
Yeah. So I was actually going to ask, how involved are you with the actual like process of the series? Or are you just, is it kind of like one of those things that as a creator, you just kind of get to be excited about it when you see the final product?
I don't know yet. That's one of those things where I'm not totally sure what my involvement's going to be because, you know, I'm an executive producer on the show or co-executive producer with, Garth Ennis, but, exactly what my role is in that, I'm not sure. I've already been in touch with some of the people, but I think right now it's like the early stages of things. So as it gets closer to actual production, I may know better what my role will be within the team.
So yeah, excited.
I hope that there's something for me to contribute. I would love to be a part of it. So
kind of sticking on the boys, if you guys have never picked it up or if you guys have, The Boys features a character named Wee Huey who has an uncanny resemblance to one Mr. Simon Pegg. What kind of inspired his design? What was it about Simon that you based the Huey off of?
I actually, when we were designing the character or coming up with the character originally, Garth had a friend named Huey that they called Wee Huey. It was based on a friend of Garth's who I met and hung out with a few times. Real nice guy. And he was wee. He was shorter than I was. He was about 5'4", and just the nicest guy, kind of unassuming. And Garth wanted it based on him, and I kept meaning to. And this was, you know, when we started it was a little harder to get digital pictures and things like that quickly. You had to carry a camera around in those days because the iPhones didn't have – I don't even think the iPhone had come out when we started developing this. But I asked Garth for photos and I never got them and it just was over, you know, neglect and oversight on my part. But, I wanted to, it got time to design the character and I couldn't quite capture him the way I wanted to. I kept drawing him in my sketchbook. He didn't have that innocence that he needed. And at the same time, I met my friend and now co-creator, Gary Whitta. We're working on a book called Oliver for Image. And, Gary had turned me on to this show called Spaced, and he had them on VHS cassettes. That's how long ago this was. And it was a BBC series. If you've not seen it, it's fantastic. It holds up very well. So I was watching Spaced, and the lead character was this young guy who worked at a comic book shop, was an aspiring comic book artist, and just made me laugh and was charming. And he looked like Huey to me. Like, I'm like, that's what's in my head that I'm not getting. So I was sketching from I'd freeze frame Spaced and did some face sketches and ran it by Garth and said, hey, what do you think? He's like, yeah, that works. So we agreed. And then I found out that he had a movie called Shaun of the Dead coming out. And so I got some stills from that. And so I started working like Simon into the comic based on his character in space. But then by the time they announced the book, some time had gone by and Shaun of the Dead was this huge hit. And I was at the San Diego Comic-Con where they had like posters up and I was sitting at the DC booth promoting The Boys. There were people walking around dressed as Shaun with the red shirt and the paddle and the cricket paddle. And so I was like, wow, this thing is already getting big. And then word got around that when the initial designs came out that I based it on Simon, and then a mutual friend of ours put us in touch, and I thought I was going to get chewed out. I mean, for me, I just thought a guy that liked comic books that much, because he clearly did from his Spaced character, and he does, would just be amused by it. I didn't think it would ever actually get on his radar. But then I found out that he had seen it, but then I thought he was going to chew me out and tell me like, you know, we're suing you or change the design or whatever. And it was the opposite. He couldn't have been more gracious and friendly about the whole experience. And he was thrilled that we were putting him in the comic book and was like, no, no, please, this is great. I love it. So he wrote a nice introduction for us where he explains, that he was quote chuffed, which is a word I can't pull off without the accent. But, so yeah, he was very supportive and continues to be. And then I ended up meeting him in person, and he's as lovely in person as you think he would be. So we got to hang out a little bit. I was always hoping that the production would get going in time for him to be the character in the movie, but time has passed, and he was feeling like he was too old for it then. So, yeah.
As I was reading, I felt like he would have been perfect for.
Oh yeah,
for
it was him to me. That's I saw him. I put his facial expressions into the scenes. I wanted it to be him. I mean, after he embraced it, because it wasn't before. I don't think I had even drawn the whole first issue by the time we had this conversation. So it would have been plenty of time for me to go and change it up if he had a problem with it before it ever hit publication. But he was so supportive of it that I went whole hog and like, I'm going to make it look as much like Simon as I can. And, you know, every time I base Spider Jerusalem on my friend Andre. And so from Transmetropolitan. So, you know, I like to use real people that I know so I can get a feel for their face. And so it looks, you know, somewhat consistent, because when you're just imagining it out of your head, it'll change. But if you have a face to look at, then you go back to when as you're learning it, then you eventually it starts to look consistent. So, you know, and in some ways I kind of thought Simon and I would be – he's somebody I thought would be a friend. And you know, ultimately we did end up becoming friendly. So he was somebody that I get along with and like. So it was fun to draw him in the comic. But I only wanted him to like it, you know.
And that's awesome. Like, I just got to say that that's really awesome. You know, I think that as I was reading The Boys, like, that was one of my favorite parts, that, you know, just the whole acknowledgement of it being cool. It's like, oh, this is so awesome. But the Boys is a fantastic series, and it takes a real good look at, you know, the underside, like you're talking about, of superheroes and stuff along those lines. If you guys have never actually listened to this right now and you guys have never checked out The Boys, I'm going to provide a link in the description below where you guys can pick it up off of Amazon. But
thank you.
This is a book that, while it is amazing in its concept and its delivery and the art, it does deal with some pretty heavy topics. And being that we are a show that deals with heavy topics like suicide prevention and depression, I would be doing our show a huge injustice. This book dives into themes of self-harm and LGBT at times. So as a creator, why did you guys choose to put these specific – or give these characters these specific traits?
I think the bigger part of it was the idea that the boys lived in a universe where superheroes were real, but they weren't what they seemed on the surface. And so getting behind the curtain on that was something of a horror show for Huey. You know, Huey's our guide through the whole thing. The idea really is more, it's less about superheroes as it is about the imbalance of power. When you have people that are powerful and in charge, they treat people that are less powerful as disposable. And I think even more than then, we are living through a similar feeling in our society where, you know, if you don't have a lot of money, somehow you don't matter. And in that world, it was the money and the power and the celebrity. The superheroes in the Boys universe, they're like celebrity politicians on steroids. You know, they can, you know, and in Garth's thinking when he was discussing the series, the concept with me was, you know, they're throwing these cars around and buildings are falling and nobody gets hurt. Well, that's just not believable. And the reason that you never see that in the, you know, mainstream comics is that it's unsettling. You know, if you actually dealt with the collateral damage of what it would be like to have these walking bombs, these self-propelling thinking, you know, nuclear weapons flying around, just getting into tussles with one another, and the rest of us have to just, it's like Godzilla, but they're in tiny 6'4" handsome uniforms, you know? And that idea was the reason you don't hear about it is because there's a whole system there to cover it up. And, you know, so when you talk about the least among us, you know, you start to talk about oppressed people and people that are treated as less than. And I think we wanted to get into that element of things where the boys would not only be of these people, but be able to stand up to those people. And I think that's what makes it such an engaging read.
And this book, you know, came out, you know, years ago,
2007 to 2012.
Right. So you guys are also, I mean, even in our day and age, we find that, you know, doing this show, there's still a lot of stigma that's around the concepts of mental health. And, you know, I would imagine even back then, there's still that stigma around, you know, these themes. Did you guys ever find like backlash from it, or was it more of like,
no, actually, the hard part was that some people misunderstood the concept. And so they looked at everything like, so when something awful was happening, some people had a knee jerk reaction to it and treated it as if we were celebrating that rather than criticizing it. We were using it as an example of like, no, this is bad. And then our characters are going to come in and, you know, deal with the badness. It's not that, but if it doesn't, you know, if there's nothing going wrong, then there's nothing to solve. Right. So if the idea that people would think that because our characters were engaging in this, or there were characters engaging in this, that somehow we were applauding it rather than exposing it. On themes. So what was ironic, so there's a character who is Butcher Superior, and they have a very aggressive sexual relationship where she likes to be submissive. And but it's consensual. It's not like something, but people misread that as something that Butcher was doing to her against her will. But she's a person in power, and so that's how she gets off. But when it came to LGBTQ, we actually, Garth took a very sensitive approach to how he handled that. And in the end, we actually ended up winning awards from the community that applauded that we handled the topic the way we did. You know, so I thought that was, and I was proud of that. I was glad that we took on themes like that, in that, you know, it was handled sensitively and intelligently, and it was different. But it was also the bad guys. It was less stereotypes, and it was more handling things as human beings, like a human story. And I'm going to...
So you guys, with the boys as well, you guys also present a group dynamic within it called the Teenage Kicks. And there's a character in that in that dynamic named Popclaw. There's a panel that stuck with me. I can't speak for anyone else, but it really stuck with me, of her cutting herself.
Yes.
And so this is, how do you feel like this is an issue that is kind of treated in our culture now, nowadays?
I think it's, I guess at the time it was more abstract for me. Like, it was just showing that I would imagine that, you know, with great power comes great responsibility is the low hanging fruit at this point for how to explore a superhero. But I also think with great power comes a lot of mental problems, because who do you relate to if you can do these extraordinary things and you don't have, and one, you got to keep it a secret. You can't talk to anybody about it, and nobody really understands what you're going through. And so I also imagine that if you were a superhero and you had to deal with these situations, for all the glamour and fun that is presented in a movie or a TV show or a mainstream comic, the other part of it is you're kind of like an EMT. I don't know if you ever saw a movie called Bringing Out the Dead, with a Martin Scorsese film from years ago with Nicolas Cage. Really good. And it shows about what just being a person working in a ambulance in New York, ongoing, like the trauma it puts him through. Like, there's nobody there to care for the people that take care of us. So I imagine that with superheroes, especially teenage superheroes, because I have teenage sons, you know, and was a teenager. I know that where I felt alienated in my own world, and where my kids feel alienated in the present day world, that that's amplified if you're somebody that, you know, is expected from. If you're one of these superheroes, you know, we know within the world of the boys that there's corporate sponsorship below that, and government IDs and things like that that are under the surface. So that'd be a lot of pressure on a kid, you know? And so when it came to Popclaw, even though we didn't really do a whole deep dive on her character, I figured the way that she cuts herself and the way she, you know, things like that, that would be a tension release. That would be a if she's traumatized, that's a way of dealing with the trauma. And from what I understand of cutting is, you know, if you're controlling your own pain, then you're not fighting, you know, you're not fighting pain. You're in control of it. It's not taking control of you. It's a way of focusing your pain by self-harm. And, you know, that's same thing with suicide. I think there's a lot of feelings with suicide that come about. It's not always about feeling like a victim as much as just feeling nothing and feeling like you don't want to belong anymore, feeling like you don't have a place to fit in or that you wouldn't be missed if you were gone. And I wonder with a character like the Teenage Kicks, they all were, you know, overindulged and had power. But where do you take that power in your quiet moments?
And that's something that as I came out of, you know, reading The Boys, that was something that I felt very appreciative of, that you guys are taking these issues and giving them a spotlight, but also showing that, you know, kind of humanizing these heroes, because, you know, our culture, especially the comic book medium, I feel like we have really kind of come to expect what, you know, a superhero should be, you know.
Yes.
Stuff like, you know, Superman or Wonder Woman or, you know, Captain America, these superheroes that have just become so iconic. But you guys really took the...
These are iconic level. Yeah, that's one of those things where I think in the... I know where your question was going, and feel free to ask again if I'm wrong. But with... those mainstream characters, like one of the things that made The Boys fun for me to work on was Garth and I had two different approaches from how we see these characters. Garth grew up in Northern Ireland, where his comic book heroes and superheroes were Judge Dredd and Dan Dare and these war comics and 2000 AD. And he doesn't have an emotional attachment to mainstream superheroes like I do. You know, my first action figure ever, I think I got when I was 4 years old or 5 years old, and it was a Batman Mego, you know. And he – I still have him. Excuse me. But he – you know, but these action figures were my first exposure to the superheroes, so it's like I have an emotional attachment to them that he doesn't. So he can look at somebody like, you know, Spider-Man or Batman and see what's silly about it. I can see what's silly about it, but it doesn't hit me that way. I get into their heads and I care about them because, you know, like that means something to me. This is something from my childhood. So we came at it from a different perspective. But that was good because for me, I just like drawing and I like dark stories. I think Garth's an incredible writer. So working at it with him, I think that's what made it work, is we were kind of a yin yang kind of a team on that book that I think another artist would not have brought the love. They would have just went for the throat, and I went for the throat, but I did it selectively. So I didn't really want to take down what made Superman great. I still love Superman. I still love Batman. I still love these characters. I love the Marvel and DC characters like their old friends. I wasn't interested in taking down them. We created corollary characters as a way of, like I was saying before, you don't just put on the outfit and become Superman. The Superman is not the outfit. It's the guy in the outfit. Same with Spider-Man. It's like, you got to be Peter Parker to be that kid. You know, if Peter Parker's an asshole, but he's got Spider-Man powers, you know, he's just another asshole with Spider-Man powers. You know, but it's the hero, you know. I really liked, really loved Homecoming, Spider-Man Homecoming, because it really showed his strength of will and him learning his way. And they didn't get too tied up in the origin. They got into the, like, what makes Peter tick, you know. And that to me is different, you know. You can have what makes The Boys universe unique in that regard is that it shows the difference between somebody in a costume and somebody with character.
And so kind of jumping over to Happy, which is the series that you had published with Grant Morrison.
And
we will, again, provide links with down below if you guys have not checked it out. It is a fantastic series. I love this series.
Thank you.
It is probably, I would compare it to Watchmen as far as how much I loved it.
Thank you.
But it's another series that really not only is it a fantastically innovative story, but it's also a story that really also kind of jumps into major mental health themes as well. So what was kind of the creative process on this one? Just kind of putting these in the background, but kind of putting, mental health and, things like illusions, stuff like that, like on the forefront.
Well, when we meet Nick Sachs in the opening of the comic, he has, his whole world has imploded. He doesn't really have anything to live for. And he is slowly committing suicide. He's just taking his time. He doesn't care if he lives or dies. He takes risky jobs. He has risky sex. He drinks himself to sleep every night. He takes whatever drug is handy because he wants to die. He has no desire to keep living, but he has to but while he's alive, he has to, make a living. And so he's just, he's just kind of walking through life. He's not living. He's just waiting for something to take him. So at the point when he meets Happy, he has now something to live for, and it's only a 4-issue story, and it's his redemption. In the end, his life means something. He gives himself for a greater good. He finds he was originally a cop and a good cop who kind of went down a dark path that he never recovered from. And that's kind of the way life can be, life will throw you a curveball and sometimes we don't get up.
And that was kind of something I really appreciate about this because, it's a story that we've seen the, good cop goes bad story, but you really get to kind of see the repercussions of his life kind of unfold, and the backstory was told very beautifully. But I found when I was researching and compiling things for this interview, I noticed that the color palette seemed a little bit brighter than it did on The Boys and a little bit brighter than it did on Trans Metropolitan. So when you're kind of planning for a project, what goes through your head as far as, kind of the set color palette or the set tone that you want to give the characters and the art for the book?
Well, with Transmetropolitan, I didn't have a lot of say-so because that was the 90s, and you sort of saw the art when it was done, and you could give feedback if you needed to, but usually it was sort of that was Nathan Irene's department, and luckily Nathan Irene is an incredibly good colorist, and I've never had a problem with anything he's done. His instincts are perfect. On The Boys, I got to work with my friend Tony Avina. And Tony will, and I could kind of direct and say, hey, I'd like it to look like this or look like that. But it was an ongoing monthly book. I didn't always have time to give feedback on the color. But if I did, Tony's always been great to, try to make me happy and also has great instincts. The Happy was a little bit unique in that it was a short series. And therefore, I was able to bring in my friend Richard Clark, who is actually a painter by trade and can pencil and ink on his own very well. But I thought he'd like the job coloring. And so I got to actually really direct the color on the first wave of pages. Tony actually would come in to finish the book because while Rich is a talented colorist, it's not – the deadlines were too much, and it's not great money for somebody that can be penciling and inking, but Tony was able to pick up what Rich started, but what Rich put down, I was able to kind of say, hey, like what I really wanted was the world of Nick Sachs to be so bleak and so gray and so twilight. I wanted it to reflect where his head was. Like he was like I said, he's walking dead at the when we meet him. You know, he doesn't care if he lives or dies. He's living in a world of squalor. And I wanted it to, so I wanted the whole color palette and a film noir kind of feel to be there. So when Happy shows up, it's contrast. And when Happy arrives, he's so bright and beautiful and fun that he doesn't look like he fits that world at all.
And again, that was one thing that I really appreciated about the art, was that contrast, like you're talking about, that film noir meets that bright, energetic nature of who Happy is. So it was so awesome to see that. And Happy actually just wrapped its first season on the Sci-Fi series. As a creator of you know, kind of seeing your creation brought to life, did you find yourself enjoying the TV show?
Yeah, it looks beautiful, and the cast is terrific.
All right, so do you have anything in the works now?
Yes. I'm working on a few things. One of them, I'm creating a comic. I'm writing and drawing with my friend Eric Lieb a series called Sparrow. It's going to be 6 issues, and it's based on the likeness and persona of Lindsey Stirling, the musician. I don't know if you are familiar, but she's very talented. She's got over 9 million YouTube followers. She just came off of a season of Dancing with the Stars where she all was like runner-up, and she's just incredibly talented, got a huge following. She's very uplifting and deals with – she's been on her own journey of – overcoming anorexia and kind of a self-made person and very inspirational. So she loves fantasy and gaming. All of her videos, she does these amazing videos where she performs and dances, but she'll take on the persona of Link from, you know, Legend of Zelda, or dress in the Assassin's Creed outfit, or dress up like a Jedi, and then write a song and perform. And she plays the violin and dances almost magically. And so we are creating a comic book, like where I'm giving her own character. I'm creating a world for her to personify. So I'm using her likeness, but we're plucking elements from her very incredible life story, from her biography. And there's a YouTube Red documentary about her. And we're just taking these pieces of her life and weaving them into who her character is. And it's called Sparrow, and it should be out at the end of the year.
Sounds awesome. And
I'm very proud of it. And I think that if you're a Lindsey Stirling fan, if you know who I'm talking about, when I say Lindsey Stirling, I think you're going to love the comic. If you've never heard of me, but you love her, you're going to love the comic. But if you're a fan of mine and you've never heard of Lindsey Stirling, I think you're going to love the comic, because unlike other sometimes when there's a celebrity comic over crossover, it's very much about just selling it on the celebrity's name. That the essence of the comic isn't necessarily very good, and we're not doing that here. I'm making a good comic that happens to have Lindsey Stirling's likeness in it, kind of the way The Boys happen to have Simon Pegg's likeness in it, but it wasn't about Simon Pegg. But in this case, it's like we want it to be a good comic on its own. If you've never heard of Lindsey Stirling and you like my work, you're going to like Sparrow. If you've never heard of me, but you like Lindsey Stirling and you kind of like comics, you're going to like Sparrow.
Well, we will be on the lookout for Sparrow. And I thank you so much for sitting down and talking all things comics, geeks, and mental health with me. It has been a pleasure and an honor to sit down with such a talent as yourself. Would you like to promote anything else while we still have you?
Yes, Oliver. For about 5 years now, I've been developing a series for Image that got sidelined by a number of things, but I keep coming back to it. I'm co-creating a book called Oliver for Image. It's a steampunk reinterpretation of Oliver Twist set in a post-apocalyptic London. It's written by Gary Whitta, who wrote Rogue One, and writes for Rebels and a number of other fantastic novels and video games. He's very talented, and we've been friends for many years, and this has been a passion project for both of us that we keep almost – it's almost there, and then it keeps getting sidelined. But I am dedicated, and I think it's right now we're on schedule to have it out early next year.
If you guys have never read Transmetropolitan, Happy, or The Boys, click the links in the descriptions below and buy these books. Derek, thank you so much. It is a true honor. You're a true talent, and we look forward to Sparrow and Oliver. But if you guys are listening to this right now and you or someone you know is struggling with suicide, addiction, self-harm, or depression, we encourage you guys to reach out. Suicide is currently the 10th leading cause of death in the United States. There are 123 suicides that take place right here in our own backyard each and every day. And for every successful one of those suicides, 25 more being attempted. So please reach out.
Can I add a little something to that?
Go for it.
Yeah, I've lost more than three friends to suicide and a brother. So just if you're in that moment and you have no reason to keep living, just remember that there are a lot of people that are going to miss you. And regardless how you think, more people are ready to take you in or help you than you realize. And even if you've got nothing to live for, it's a permanent solution to a temporary problem. And the pain, if you can't stay alive for you, stay alive for the people that love you, because they will miss you.
It's beautiful. And pain, like he was just saying, pain, when you commit suicide, it doesn't actually stop the pain. It only transfers it to those that are around you.
Survivors. Yeah.
So you guys can reach out to us on any of our social media. There's links in the descriptions below. But you guys can also call the Suicide Lifeline. It's 1-800-273-8255, or also text anonymously to 741-741. But that is going to do it for us here at Victims and Villains for this episode. So if you guys have not checked out any of these series, we highly encourage you guys to click the links in the descriptions below. Please go support Mr. Robertson. He is a force to behold, and just a true talent. And it's been an honor to have him on the show. So until next time, remember, keep talking nerd, talking hope, and speaking nothing else. We'll see you guys soon.